Oh, Salter Grove. Well, it's one of my favorite places.
Not until I became older did I understand the history, how sacred this land and this property and the waters.
There wasn't much wildlife because evidently, according to some records I've read, that in some of the early purchases in the 1660s, Carpenter and the Arnold family bought land. Most of that land was cleared prior to the English arrival, and the Indians planted, as far as I know, they planted corn and beans and their squash and so forth. And that was the same true of Spring Green, the adjacent farm to the south of Warwick Downs. And that the land was cleared, so when John Green made the purchase in 1642, three months prior to Samuel Gorton and his followers settling in the Shawmut area, the land that they purchased was cleared. So, and they said the same was true of that area all the way down through Salter Grove and so forth. But Salter Grove being rocky, I would imagine that some of that land there would have been left in woodlands. So every farm had a woodlot. So you had to depend on firewood. But there were great sheep farms and so forth. They were having a grand party one time in 1896 or 7 in early spring. There was a loose joint in the furnace. The entire place went up in flames and burned to the ground. So they lost the clubhouse, but they still continued as a golf course for a number of years. And the golf course ran down around an area we call is Salter Park. Or when I was growing up, it was just Warwick Downs. After the fire, the Warwick Downs community began to expand, and these campsites then developed into the campsites, into cottages. And there were about 30 or 40 of these little cottages on an area known as the Downs. In 1905, there was a Parks Recreation expansion program. One of the areas under consideration for this Rhode Island park system was Salter Grove. So they had enough money available to construct Narragansett Parkway, and they purchased from the country club folks the area known as Salter Grove. Now, this once they purchased it, the people had cottages on the property. Were squatters. They had a lease that probably ran from season to season or month to month. The state then requested these houses removed. So about 30-35 of these little cottages that dotted the entire landscape over there were demolished. Warwick Downs. That was all demolished by 1925. I think they removed all the houses by 25, so there weren't any houses there. Salter's Grove, when they took that for the park, though, I think there were 37 houses there. And I counted them on the map. Mrs. Morrison was the last one, because when she got put out down there, they tore the store down.
Well, then, when it was, there were no condominiums there. It was all woods and marshland. Mm. You know, so it was just this vast area where after a busy day or whatever, or doing chores around the house, he could just go for 20 minutes, half hour.
Country club there, is that what
it was? The country club.
Country club, yeah.
There was a golf course, though? Hmm. When I say country club?
I don't know about a golf course.
Was it a golf course?
There was a golf course there, the country club.
No and, kidding, yeah.
This is the Warwick Downs where we used to hang out.
Oh, yeah?
As time went on, we developed friendships down in the campground. So there were some of the Swedes lived in that area. A good many came from the area known as Warwick Downs, and it was a campground. The cottages had been built after 1900. They developed from campground into year-round homes. So by 1938, it was quite an established community. And, of course, they built around the edge this high bank overlooking Narragansett Bay. It was a great impact on the Salter Grove and Warwick Downs during the time of the Great Hurricane. My grandfather used to call it the Great Gale, 1938. My friend Jack Wallace, who lived there, he said that there was a great tidal wave that came in. He said three large waves came in. He said the first wave shook the bank, and he said the second wave came in. The house began to crumble. Third wave, that just took everything out, and everything was just hanging wires.
this those map. Are the ones that got wiped out, Henry. All of these at Salters Grove. And the ones on the island got wiped out too in 38.
The interesting thing about it is behind it shows the steam the engine. And that was the engine that they had a windlass on it and they tied a rope, and that would lift the buckets of coal out of the barge and to an arm. And that arm, like this, would swing back with the load of coal, and then they could lower the bucket of coal into the little wagons and roll it back. It's amazing what was here.
All kinds of diving, and that was a coal dock, and they have never found a piece of coal.
Oh, really?
Oh, they did.
They never found a piece of coal.
The hitch lift, when they're doing their gardening, they've never.
Oh, they did. Enough. They found a coal.
Did they find some?
No, he said they never did. Oh. He said they never found any coal.
When they were doing the gardening and weeding, they never dug up any coal. Do you think the place would be full of coal?
I figured it'd be loaded with coal.
Yeah, but they. I asked many times.
Well, that. The railroad, the little railroad that was there, you know, that little track of thought must have gone way back. So the coal evidently was lifted, lifted by the crane, put into the
and
little
coal way back.
And then rolled back 300 or 400 feet.
Yeah. Maybe back to the lane almost. I don't know.
It was a carpenter that lived next to my youngest daughter in Coventry. He's not there anymore. And I said to him, I've drawn the plans for what used to be our summer cottage. And I said, I'd like you to make me a replica of it. And so he said, okay. But as we went on, I had named a price. He just kept upping it. Well, it's taken me longer, so it ended up being almost $300 by the time I was done with it. But that's where I had it made by him. And he'd have me go over to his house sometime and see how he was coming. Now, which part goes where? So that's what we do. We had been living with my father's mother, and she was rather difficult. So my mother said, I'm not staying here over the holidays. So we went down the beach, and we got the kerosene stove going. I made this stove out of a Band-Aid box,
great.
It would look, and with the back on it, which would have been the plate. We had an oak table, and there was always a deck of cards on it when we weren't eating, and checkers, can of beer for my dad, and he had exactly one of these chairs that swivels for that. Mm. That was kind of his place there. I put that right down in front of there. We had a couch that opened up that my mother and father slept on, right there. And we had, everything is the way it was. We've got a table over there, but we had a radio that looked just like that, the oldies. So that was there. And we had one of these stained glass lamps hanging right over the table with all the grapes and everything. It was so pretty. One night during that Christmas holiday, my mother and father felt bad. There was a dog outside that was howling. And they said, oh, the poor thing, he's whimpering. Let's bring him in. It was cold. It was rainy. And they brought him in, and they put him over near the kerosene heater. And they went to bed eventually. My mother woke up during the night and said to Joe, move over. And what? The dog was sleeping between the two of them, so more than she bargained for.
Salter Grove? I think it was called that.
Metropolitan Park.
Oh, is that what it was?
I think it was owned by the Metropolitan Land Company, so we always call it Metropolitan Park.
Oh.
Yeah, right, Henry?
Salter Grove, named after George Salter.
May 28th, 1967 was the day of the dedication with Chafee.
That was my grandfather's favorite spot. Nobody knew that. And it was just such irony that they would choose a place like that and name it in his honor. And I asked a few of my relatives and stuff, you know, I was little, so I remember the story from Grandma, but what? He just liked the peace and tranquility. He would just go down there and watch the water, watch the boats, watch the birds. And then they didn't have the parking lot, and you could drive your car all back up into it. Mm-hmm. And you could get pretty much close to the edge. can't do that anymore. You have to change it. Things have to change. Change isn't a bad thing. But that was one of his favorite spots. It was just a weird, weird thing to choose that spot. It was very appropriate. So just 20 minutes, half hour, just sit there, relax. He'd grab the paper and just relax. It was very calming, very comforting to him. And it was just a beautiful spot where there was so much nature then, where you could kind of escape and you can remove yourself from the houses and traffic and cars. And it was like a little escape. And that's why he liked going there so much. The reason the park was named in his honor, my grandfather was very politically involved. He ran for mayor for the city of Warwick, lost. But he still ran for mayor for the city of Warwick. He was a councilman. He was police commissioner, fire commissioner. He did a lot with the Patuxent Village Fire Volunteer Fire Department. He was very well known, very well liked, because of all these achievements that he had had in his life. It says, in memoriam, the children in the Fair Street section of Warwick will long remember George Salter, although not as an insurance executive or as a political figure, but as the nice man who gave them the first ride on the rail fire truck. Every holiday in the nice weather, he would get one of the antique fire engines, load up all the children around, believe me, there were many, and take them all around Patuxent and the Lakewood area. Some of the fathers and brothers commandeered to ride on back to see that all stayed safely seated. What a thrill for a child to hear the roar of the engine and to be able to ring the old fire bell. And what a sight it was to see the hot summer holidays, a fire truck full of laughing, shouting children. I know most mothers have pictures of those happy occasions. I'm sure the children in our neighborhood will always think of Mr. Salter whenever they see a bright, shiny fire truck and remember those happy holidays.
Okay, the Grove. White wings, black wings, brown wings, cats, insects, ivy, jetty, bats, brambles, reeds and swamp marsh trees, rock-faced wildflowers, benches, bees, Gaspy Plateau's children play on Narragansett Parkway.
Being a child and even growing up and still having very fond memories, I've always called it my grandfather's park. Other people have called it the Metro, the Downs, the Grove. No, I've always called it my grandfather's park. Like I owned it, right?
When I first got there, I think in 95, the road went all the way around and now it doesn't go around anymore. I miss that little road.
This obviously is a coastal jewel. And at the time Lincoln Chafee became mayor in 1992, the park had been managed by the state for a number of years, yet was unimproved to a large extent. It had been run down. There was a road system, a very informal road system that went into the park. Motorists were free to drive recklessly through park anywhere they wanted, and as a result, it was used largely by people who were taking a break during the day and wanted a vista and a lunch. Also, after dark, it was notoriously abused for teenage parties and other things. That obviously is a step in the wrong direction, and there was a priority made to bring the park back. And that it was, the assumption was made if we improved it, if we fixed it up, that neighbors and people who love this park would come back and reclaim it.
But I hear a lot of that story. I like meet people and they're like, yeah, like we used to come out here, you know, this is the hangout place, like 20, 30 years ago, sure. Where like, you know, they'd bring a girl to come here and smoke pot. You know?
Kids in the beer bottle.
The sewer authority was looking for an ideal spot for a pumping station. Because this is a state-owned property, sewer authority was in negotiation with DEM to acquire an easement to site a pumping station. I was aware of this and a little wary. One day I was walking around the area and discovered that there were sticks with red or orange tape on it, meaning that they had decided where to site this station. It was right in the middle of the meadow, right in the middle of the playground. It wasn't sited sensitively to one corner or another. It was going to be the most prominent feature of the park, and that was enough to have me call DEM, immediately interjected the city, as opposed to the city sewer authority, into the negotiations. As a result, we were successful in the ability to site the sump pumping station over to a relatively obscure corner so it wouldn't have such a profile, and to have it bricked and have some semblance of an architectural exterior as opposed to a concrete block cube. At the same time, the city had to make a commitment to manage the park. That was the price to pay. And we ended up negotiating a 20-year agreement where the city was going to take over the management, and we decided at the same time to depart from a passive management style and put together a capital investment to allow people to really enjoy the park and to control the renegade usage and the destruction caused by cars driving all around. So the city, over the next 2 years, developed and got permitted a project which included landscaping and a formal roadway system, a loop with parking, and a flagpole, and replacing the guardrails, and put this in at a cost of about $75,000, of which I think we got $25,000 from the state in the form of a matching grant. So around the spring of 1997, we finished the project. We also attempted to make it safer for people to access the breakwater, which is clearly an amazing asset to the park. It's hardly any other coastal area in the state or in this region has a mile-long jetty that you can walk out, and it's really the most wonderful public access in this whole urbanized area. It was such a major improvement that it didn't attract a whole lot of criticism. Everybody seemed pretty supportive.
This is fabulous.
When the jetty was built in 1964, 1965, there was a jetty constructed to allow the equipment personnel to get out there, and the plan, the causeway. Yeah. And the causeway was always planned to be taken out, yeah. But the municipal officials at the time had requested they keep the causeway in for public access. So they popped in a couple of, 24-inch culverts, I believe, or 36-inch culverts, which have long since silted in. There's never been any maintenance. And there's a question as to whether if you retrofitted those with substantial culverts to allow for a flush, that, mm-hmm. that would prevent atrophy and sedimentation. And so that remains a question to this day.
Not until I became older did I understand the history, how sacred this land and this property and the waters and the break wall. I mean, I would go down to the break wall, and I used to go down as an 11, 10, 12-year-old. And, you know, if you keep walking down the break wall there's those islands. And in high tide, you can't get there, but in low tide, you could. Well, there were many days I got marooned out there because the tide had come in, and it was a safe place for me to bathe naked. I loved it, you know? It was a lovely, you know, it was just safe. Always being down here was very, very safe.
Why wouldn't DEM just give us this site? They wanted to give us this site. This is a management nightmare for a state agency, a 10-acre parcel in their portfolio of thousands of acres. The answer is that the state came into ownership of Salter Grove by virtue of a state commission back in the teens. The small encampments were acquired by eminent domain with the provision that in the event that the state was not going to ultimately use the property and want to relinquish it, it first had to go to the owners or heirs of the property. So that would keep the lawyers busy for a long time. So it was felt that an agreement that would allow us to manage the city, to manage the park, was the most practical thing. And the state was very pleased about that. They were almost too happy to give us the $30,000 to help improve the park. It's not just dollars, but a big constraint to projects like improving Salter Grove is the amount of time and effort you need to get the permitting, get the design, get the neighborhood input and approval. It takes some for a government technocrat, it's it can be daunting. Ultimately, to have something like Salta Grove is just a huge, there's a huge personal reward in having people appreciate it. There it was. It was derelict. It was a dumping ground. It was a party site. And people were afraid to go in there after dark. And yet, it's just, it is a jewel. And it is reclaimed. 10 years later, it seems to be a real valuable place. Really a place that people enjoy and can take a deep breath and get a lot of negative ions and relax and enjoy life. You have 85,000 people in a city 36 square miles with 35 miles of coastline. You try and do what is achievable. Haven't received too many complaints on this.
This is Rock Island right here.
Rock Island, I've been always fascinated with Rock Island. And about 6 or 7 years ago, a friend of mine who lives in Patuxent, but on the Cranston side, he did work for an auctioneer in New York. And one of the documents that he was researching and was a deed, he copied for me, and it was a deed, 1737, was the lease of Rock Island by the proprietors of Patuxent to two gentlemen. Those two gentlemen, they leased the land, and they spoke in 1737 of upland meadows, they talked of salt marsh, they talked of flooding pastures and so forth. The proprietors of Tuxet were the gentlemen who joined Roger Williams in 1636, and then several years later they felt that they should they had a different viewpoint on religion, and they signed a they drew lots. They settled in the area we know as Patuxent on the Cranston side. And if you cross the bridge, as there's a sign that's just been renovated by the city of Cranston, it mentions the boundaries of Roger Williams' boundary and so forth of the Providence Purchase by the Indians to Roger Williams. So, anyway, getting back to 1737, we're fast forward here. The folks that bought that land were allowed to take stones, and stones then were sold as building material. But they also, it's interesting, the proprietors wrote into the deed that the stones couldn't be transported more than 2 miles from Patuxent. It's all quite interesting. But the proprietors had settled lots and so forth. So by 1737, the proprietors, the original members, had most of them had died by 1665. So by 1737, you had second and third generation ownership, proprietors, ownership in Patuxent. So it's interesting to see all the deeds that and who signed the deeds of the proprietors' descendants who signed the deed allowing the folks to cut grass on the island. So the island, what we see it as a little tiny narrow strip today. It must have been quite extensive piece of property. I talked to a lady, Patuxent, Madeline Toy, and her grandfather, Peck, had this pictures and photographs showing Mr. Peck sitting on Rock Island, mm-hmm. and there are three or four houses. Frank Pettis told me that he knew the Anthony brothers, and the Anthony brothers had a little yacht club out there.
And we went over. We said, "Let's make a picnic." And so we said, "Okay, grab some sandwiches," and got in Murray's boat, which you rowed, and oared. Used the oars, and we went over to Rock Island, the island, and I found out years later it was called Rock Island. Margaret, I went to get out of the boat, and I said to Margaret, "Look at the pretty rabbits." She said, "They're white rats. Get back in the boat." So we jumped back, and I said, "Well, what do you want to do?" She said, "Elsie Boothroyd's brother just came home from the service on a visit. We'll row up to Patuxent and go visit Mrs. Boothroyd." So we did that. By the time we came back, which was probably because we lollygagged around, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, my mother was waiting. She right on the shore, and she said, "You're not to see Margaret Murray for 2 weeks at least. You're always getting in trouble with Margaret." Well, I was adventuresome as she was, you know, but I mean, also didn't have much fear. Mm-hmm. And we, as they said, we used to figure that the life preservers, we could always use those, big bulky things, and they were from World War One. And if we had to depend on them, we would have sunk. They were just so heavy, if they, especially in the water. That's I was great. Probably 11. We went out on the boat one day when all of a sudden the big tanker came by. And we started to notice we were getting quite a ripple in the water. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, let's go to the, we used to call those posts, channel post, and we'll hold on so we don't get tipped over. Well, at Parnham Lighthouse, they're yelling at us, "What's the matter with you kids?" We thought it was great. We thought it was a lot of fun, rocking back and forth, watching the tanker go by, but we never did it again.
We do Tuck Hunting at Rock Island, and one time, early, very, very early in the morning, the sun was just rising, and another fellow and I had set our decoys up on the rocks. Lo and behold, out of the eastern sky, we saw two very large white birds coming down the bay, and they were flying low to the water as they came, and they headed right for our decoys, and they flew over the top of the decoys. As they did, we set a volley out and so forth, and we missed the birds. And they were, I said, "I've never seen a bird so large as great white birds." And I first thought they were snow geese. It turns out they were swans, the mute swans. And today we have hundreds and hundreds of mute swans dotting Salter Grove.
You know, at the break wall, I would call it the island. I would walk down there and just be alone, you know, have some serenity or peace and not people around me. Mm-hmm. And I felt safe, although I think I got caught a few times. But I mean, you know, as teenagers, we'd come down here a lot and gather. It was a wonderful gathering place. And that's what I see, you know, living up the street, that this is a wonderful gathering place for people to come. It was the Downs. And I still refer to it as the Downs.
You saw the tents where the dance hall was.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, yeah. There were tents. People used to pitch tents out there.
Yeah, yeah.
Because people used to pitch tents all around that area.
Yeah.
Come down for the summer, right?
Yeah. And you just come down with a wagon or load the stuff and pitch a tent.
We had bonfires on the beach. We used to jump ice cakes.
Yeah.
Did you remember?
I remember that.
I don't know.
So how we didn't drown.
I don't. I was talking to Harrigan about that. He says, we used to go bendies too. He says, but we'd usually end up in the water.
You know what bendies is? When the ice is raw, you know, ice is coarse, and then, you know, you get down to the soft place, the ice begins to bend, you know.
We used to go to dances and then occasions at the Warwick Downs Assembly, we called it. It later became what, VFW or American Legion? And then it burned down.
Well, we just came by there, and it looks just about the same as it always did. There was a Salter Grove. Mm-hmm. And I was remembering that just south of there was a large, like an assembly hall, the sort of place where you'd hold bingos or something like that, and that's no longer there. But I remember going over there, and during the winter, there's a slight hill, and we would take our sleds and go sliding there.
We still do.
There were still lots of open fields and meadows, and we'd play baseball. It was lots of fun. And then they also, I understand that the Community Association of Warwick Downs always had a great festival at Labor Day. So at Labor Day, they'd have swimming races and tub races and rowboats and so forth and horseshoes, and they'd have Community Association finally built a community hall where they had, then later on had dances. I don't know if they had bingos or not, but it was quite an association of ladies, and they ran all kinds of events, evenings, card playing and so forth. So they didn't have TV and they didn't have electronic gadgets we have today. So communities organized, were tightly knit. They organized social activities on a daily basis.
Yeah, I'd love to go by there and look at some memory. Mm. The Pedleys.
Oh, yeah.
Remember Loretta Pedley and Eddie Pedley and the Hokers? And
no.
The Feenies. Do you remember Feenies. Donald Feeney?
Feenies.
Donald
yeah.
Feeney, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Timmy Sullivan was down there.
Yeah. But the ball games, they used to have the ball games down there.
The ball field.
Yeah, the ball field was up in the back.
Right, yeah. And nobody remembers the store hardly.
There yeah,
was
the little store.
Drive. There was a store. If you went beyond first base,
yeah,
right
there was a little store. And Carl Johnson said that was a shoebox store. And I said, well, who owned it? He said, I don't know, it was a shoebox store. He said, we call it, used to call it the shoebox.
Someone has pictures of that store, right?
Is that right?
One Country Club Drive, yeah.
So anyway, that's all I put. So when I wrote the little history, I said, well, there's a shoebox store next to the ball field.
Mm.
Used to sell soda pops.
Yeah. It was a nice store, though. I mean, it wasn't tiny.
Tiny.
It wasn't too tiny, though. I don't know.
Well, Carl Johnson says shoebox. I said, well, that's okay. Shoebox, a good name for the store.
There was several. There was the Salisbury store. There was Max. There was Boothroyd's. There was Park Country Club Drive.
Yeah.
Stockard's down here.
Stockard's.
Stockard's, yeah.
Yeah.
There were variety stores all over the place. The ball field was Landon Road, which is off of Park. If you're Wyman School, you get down the hill to the left. And it ended. There was one row of houses on Country Club Drive.
Right.
One row. Audubon was part of the ball field. Left field was the Nicholsons.
Yeah.
Right. Center field was the Bulgers. Yeah. And right field was the store.
Yeah.
It was a ball field. In fact, it's incredible. But they had this huge, like huge toolbox. You could go down there and open it up and take a glove, a bat, a ball right out of there and play ball. And nobody stole anything back then.
And you put it back.
And you put it back there, yeah. It was
nobody
a big,
had any
big
balls
container.
Or gloves or bats and things.
And there was a Warwick Downs ball club.
This all used to be Summer Colony.
Yeah.
I mean,
oh, yeah.
I remember fellas telling me they would go swimming here.
Oh, yeah. I used to swim here. Yeah. The beach would be crowded on a summer day.
They would take the streetcar from the city. That was a big trip to come out here to Warwick Cove and go swimming.
Yeah.
That's about the extent of my memories there, except the beach there. I think it was called Grant's Beach, and there was a small grocery store there. We used to go swimming there sometimes, and most of the time we went swimming at Swedish Beach, which was closer to Conanchet Avenue.
Yeah, the beach, they always had a lifeguard there, and there was a raft, right? There was a raft always there. You'd swim out to the raft, and if you felt ambitious, you'd swim over to Crescent Park.
Yeah.
And we'd always hear the roller coaster across the way. You could always hear that.
We used to
look
at the roller coaster go over a high peak.
Yeah.
And then you could hear it roar down.
You could hear it roar down, yep, from the side.
Yeah, that's the highest part. You could see it from here. You can see the cars climb up slow, reach the top. You can hear it. You can hear the roar of the wheels.
Wonderful,
on a Sunday
wonderful
or Saturday
place.
Afternoon, this time of the year, walk down just to be crowded with people. Blankets all over the beach and all over that bank and by the park.
We had some grand times down there.
It was crowded with people. That's before all the beach grew up. I remember that I received my life-saving award at Warwick Downs Beach back in 1938 or so. They had a lifeguard there who had classes for kids to be lifesavers or get their badge. It really used to be a great place to go. And it's still a great place to go, but not for swimming. In fact, I think swimming today would be safe there as opposed to swimming there 40, 50 years ago because, as I remember, all these houses along the waterfront had pipes going out into the cove, and all their waste went into the cove, and down to Warwick Downs Beach. We lived and we survived.
How do you feel the water is over there now? How about Warwick Downs? Is it cleaner now than it was several years ago? Is it on an upturn?
I think it's cleaner than it was.
It's south of Swedish Village, yeah.
Yeah.
But there was George Church. Remember George Church?
Yeah.
And Whitey the painter.
Hmm.
And then there was, of course, the Beauvais.
Yeah.
He was a bridge builder, Mr. Beauvais.
Yeah.
And, oh, Kenny, Bill Kenny, used to summer down there. The field is named after him on Jefferson Boulevard.
Kenny Manufacturing.
Kenny Manufacturing, right. Mm. And he used to come with Abner Lawton and Abner's sister. The George Church down the Downs. Of course, there was Art Bonneau, there was Church, and Max Store was there. Yeah. Max Store was right at the edge of Swedish Village.
Yeah, did you know the Aubins?
Oh, yeah, the Aubins, they were great carpenters. Great carpenters, they were right straight down Marine.
Jack McGinnis used to have a house.
Yeah.
He was on Marine and...
Pomfreys, the Pedleys, the Hokers, Jimmy Sullivan. Harrigan's, old Harrigan's relatives.
The land company to the said, "Sure, do you want to buy your lot and house and so forth?"
If
some did and some didn't, the ones that didn't,
right, they had them out. But you couldn't buy if it was going to be on a street. Like they couldn't buy, but Harrigan's could because the street was planned right there.
Oh,
that's why they were able to buy.
Oh.
And Gavrilin. Mm-hmm. The Gavrilins are still there. I remember there was a parrot next to Harrigan's house, right here, Polly, right here.
Yeah.
We used to talk to all the time.
Yeah. Clam bake was always held at Warwick Downs, Salter Park, and there was a great rock down in Salter Park, and so I always find that very convenient to set the bake right next to that big, large rock, and used 4-foot lengths of cordwood. And layer of stone, layer of cordwood and stone, and then we put the clams. The first layer would be this, of course, the rock. Once the rocks were, after it was fired, the rocks would be superheated, and seaweed, about 3 or 4 inches of seaweed would be on the top, and then the clams would be placed, and then potatoes and sweet corn. And then we'd serve watermelon afterwards, and of course there was a great ceremony in chopping the lobsters up, and with the lobsters were always placed on the top, and so we removed the canvas. There were, hundreds of people would come down, and they would stand around, and this great cloud of steam emitted, and then the lobsters, those, and they would be bright red, and they're just laying on top of the. Of the sweet corn and onions, and the there were potatoes, sweet potatoes, and the white potatoes, and they were diced. We also had a little pork sausage known as a buckwurst, and that came from Soggy's, the Soggy Company, and Soggy Company is known for a wiener that was made. And it was just wonderful, and everybody gathered in. So it wasn't just confined to the 30 or 40 so-called members of this that joined in to put the bake together, but it was everybody in the whole in that who bought tickets just joined in the festivities. So it was a big family outing. And 1972, during the bicentennial of the Gatsby's, that was a real banner year, and it was that time that we. I believe we had something like almost 800 bakes that we served, and it was just amazing to the involvement of families, and we borrowed tables from various churches and chairs, and the donations. It was amazing, the donations, and so there was always plenty of extra food left over for people to take home, or people just stopping in. They'd curious at what was going on, and they'd walk around Salter Grove and have a peek at the Narragansett Bay and the beauties of the area. It was lots of fun putting it together. It was grand.
Of my first kiss.
You know, that stuck with me. That's making amazing. Out in a car stuck with me.
It used to be just an area, kind of a rustic area, where people would just go in, change the oil in their automobiles, and leave containers of oil, and it was known also Lover's Park. I remember also known as Lover's Park.
They call it Salter's Grove now, but I can remember that. And we called it Lover's Lane. And we saw a couple sitting in a car, I think it only happened once, because I went with a couple of the older ones, and they called it bushwhacking. And we go, oh! And then we'd run so that nobody would get us. How foolish the chances you take.
Into the park is when they were down in the park. Who was it that was shaking the cars? No, that's what they did. That's what the kids did. Down at the park, when the parkers were there, the young people.
Yeah.
The kids would go over there and shake the car.
Shake the car.
And then they would, if the car, and then they would even put stones behind the car so that people. I didn't do that, but I know I've heard these stories. And then there was like a swamp. You know that swamp area down there?
Yeah.
They used to have like planks across there. So at night, they'd run across the planks. But the other people that were chasing them didn't know the planks was there. And then run right into the swampy area.
So it's just down by a little pond?
And it was the site of my first kiss. And I have to say it was as innocent and as exciting as a first kiss should be.
I don't think we shook her car, Henry. Just joking. The little pond.
We used to skate there too.
Yeah.
There's a big tree in there now. A tree came down. We used to skate on that.
Yeah.
Area. We used to skate on here all the time.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, my grandchildren used to skate out here.
I got pictures of '91. This froze over.
Oh yeah.
And I was out there with a sled, way out off Caspi Point, and you could. Oh, we were swinging the sled. It was so smooth. It was. Swinging the sled all around in a circle.
Yeah.
And, but that's the last time it's froze over.
Yeah, 91. I got pictures of my grandchildren.
Had any ice since.
91, that was,
It's been warm.
Were they at Halloween? What did they do to the outhouses down there?
Yeah, they tip them over.
With people inside?
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe.
I don't know
whether they bothered to look.
They said one of the old ladies was in the outhouse, and the boys were trying to tip the house over. She screamed, and they let the outhouse go, and it kept crashing up.
Oh, boy.
Beyond Colvin Grove, beyond me is a tree. Beyond that, rocks and brush drop down into marsh and high tide. Beyond that is a cove with mollusks, fish, egrets, herons, and swans with their offspring pecking along the coast. Beyond them are rocky islets with reeds and trees, a fisherman or three, and a pair of lovers. Beyond them is the bay channel with sail and motorboats, a tug, barges, and a freighter. Beyond that is the other side of the mainland with docks and houses and hillsides swelling with trees. Behind me is a small park, and across the street, suburban geometries. Above me and around me is the cicada's insistence. The birds warble, whistle, and caw. Before me, behind me, around me, above me, within me, without me is the current of sap and blood, of water and air, a particle and wave, of solar wind and lunar tide, of being and beyond being.
The water was filled with crabs, thousands of crabs, blue crabs. And they scuttle along, you know, you'd have the net, you'd scuttle.
Oh, yeah,
the place is loaded with pheasants. Oh, it was loaded with pheasants, thousands of them, ring that pheasants.
It would fly up Narragansett Bay, and then the first light, with the sound of gunfire, immense clouds of ducks, thousands and thousands, and I mean thousands. There were rafts of ducks. Sometimes I remember rafts of ducks of 10 and 20, 30,000 ducks, and the water was black. As soon as the first gunfire started, the ducks would just fly up in huge flocks, and you could hear the water, the wings beating on the water, and they'd flap and so forth, and the clouds would rise up, and they would pass before the sun. I would say it would just darken the sun, but it was a sight to behold, to see these thousands of ducks fleeing the gunshots. And then, of course, in the evening, then the ducks would fly up the bay in small numbers and gather in huge flocks and then repeat the same process. There were immense, there were bluebills, the lesser and greater scop. There were very few black ducks would have come occasionally, but most of the black ducks you find on the freshwater ponds. We didn't have many mallards. You see mallards today. If you go down to Patuxent Cove, and you'll see lots and lots of mallards. You'll see Canadian geese. There were no Canadian geese. I never saw a Canadian goose in the 1960s. We had merkants. Merkants would sort of come in December. Then you'd have you would have bluebills and golden eyes and green-winged teals. There were just an amazing variety. There must have been 14 or 15 variety of species that we have to identify as part of the duck hunting process. You not only shot the ducks, but you had to understand what they were and be able to identify the ducks.
It resonates for me for some reason. I don't know why. That place is very special.
Those houses, that's high. Those are right down below. We used to catch, because we went frost fishing every year.
Yeah, I used to go frost fishing, right?
And then we'd get crabs. Boil them right on the beach at night. Yep.
Wow.
And you go out with a spear and a flashlight. Clean them.
Henry used to frost fish.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I still have the spears.
Yeah. The frost I got spears. A spear at home, yeah.
I think I was one of the first color person there. There was like so much of anybody else. Then, like a couple of years later, just more and more different kind of people. That was just like hanging around all day. I was there like all day from probably like 7 in the morning to like 3 p.m. Just running around back and forth across the rock. I usually run after the schools. schools are blue. Like it goes, to the one end, then it comes back. I'd be chasing me after it. Finally just standing there, there's several other people, and just casting like with a 14-pound line for like skipjacks, and just like huge splash, jump out of the water, like boom, like crashing. I'm like, oh my god, what is that? Just like, so I'm like, oh my god, it's huge. I was trying to do like blue or stripers. It took me about like half an hour to reel it in. Because, like, I know, like, if I try to reel it in, the 14-pound line would just snap. So, I finally, I was kind of, like, afraid of it. I didn't want to take it. I feel so bad. I was so big. I was like, oh, my God, he must be really old. So, like, I'll take it. I'll give it to somebody. I'll give it to my mom. But all these guys, like, that's a monster. And, everybody just, like, rush in and try to, like, catch some more. It's like, I think that's the only one, like, just hanging around. Mm. Like that old, or that big, but that was fun.
And how big was that, you think?
It was like 46, 47 inches. It came up like over past my waist. It took me about 20 minutes to walk through the car too, because it was so heavy. Mm. Like I carry it like this on my hand, like and then in front of my shoulder, and then I'm dragging it. I don't know how to stop. I can just rest. It's a pretty big fish. I wanted to get it mounted, like freeze dried it. It's like they want like $700 for it, something like that. I was like, oh, forget it. It's too much. It would have been nice. I feel bad because like when I saw the head, like it just opened its mouth. You can see like all go through. So like I kind of went on top of it to grab it, I don't know. I had all these things going through my head. I'm like, oh my god, it's a really old fish. You must be like like a grandpa hanging around or something. But I took this. So, I don't know, like also like kind of like a proof that I caught it.
I come, I want to be here, like, my son, he don't like stay home, like play around by himself, because his sister like he go to school and then he like racing me all the time, you know. And daddy go to park, daddy go fishing, and now I now he relax probably like a couple hour, and then go home, take a shower, and then watch cartoon. That's all. Yeah, watch cartoon, and after I like go to work.
I always like run into people that I know here. Maybe you guys have the question, and I can ask them the question, because I was just kind of tell a little bit of the
maybe
story
they could describe
what
they're
doing.
Catching and how they use them.
Okay. Cắt trăng đang ở được chập chập say kê và nhóm đang ở chập cặp bươi đang đang chập cà phê đang vô tới thơ say kê đang ở chập cái này đang đang chập đang vô tới thơ say
như thế khóc
lên nhâm lên vui nằm một cái bia đang they use it in like some kind of stir fry, as I don't know, hors d'oeuvre or something. Like, I mean, just like with beer and things like that, you know.
Cooking.
No, like for drinking, like,
oh.
You know, when you're drinking, it's it's like little snacks.
Snacks.
You want, right, right, things like that.
Are they fried?
Yeah, yeah. I think I've seen like they actually make that. Like they do it into some kind of rice pancake in Cambodia.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What do they call them?
These things,
mm-hmm.
I think that's some kind of shrimps, right?
Yeah, I mean, what is the term?
Oh, and come here. I don't know how to say it. You want to say and come here?
Sure.
It's kapu, which is shrimp.
Okay.
So. Anything else? Mao lấy nước chả hơn Mao xa Mao đã là
từ du Mao đó.
It's about like 2 to 3 weeks. They can like once every 2 to 3 weeks.
And these things that they're catching, do they are they always here, or is it like, you know, how the fish, they have to find where they run, or are they always here?
Cắt trăng đăng tha bê cặp bươi nâng về mau về nâng nâng là hốt đó you you về mau mà đó
hai về mau ra ngay đăng phụ ấy đang tập chọc tấu về tập lao mà quýt về mau đây
you saying when the like when the tides go out, when it comes back in, it comes in with the tide.
Languages of the land. I cannot pronounce Greek letters, although I can read Latin aloud, comprehending about as much in Spanish too. At the Grove, Cambodian and other Asian scripts are untranslatable as sounds that sense. Swedish, Gaelic, Italian, French, only whispers with the native tongues of the lost days. So too, the birds' dialogues, the incessant insect speech, the warbling winds, the silent mouthing fish, the wavering reeds and grasses, the edged lips of tide, the plash of foot and fish. These languages do not worry me as much as the words of tugs and tankers, buoys and barges. One accidental misreading of these, and the song of the grove is silenced for many days by the language of the land.
No, I just noticed just the different, more different culture there every year. Like this past couple of years seemed like a more African, Cape Verde, yeah, more Latinos, definitely, but there's a nice group of people there. It's like the Hmong, it's a good mixture. I think a couple of Brazilian a couple of times, but there's all different kind of people, you know.
It's more of a place where you just come out and hang out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not like we come here like to fish professionally,
right.
Throw the poles, relax, chill. It's like one place where nobody comes and bother. Just come out here and have fun, that's all.
People
relax.
Bother you,
we relax. That's it. You know? Nobody comes and bothers us. So, I don't know. I think maybe I wouldn't be good interviewer. One of these guys over here, maybe.
Yeah.
My English ain't all that good.
I was like on that little bridge to cross over, and by myself, like it's like a school of skipjack coming. Like I'm trying to catch it, I can't catch it. You know, also no, it's like it's about 10 people all around me, and they're all like catching every cast. They're catching them, but I can't seem to catch them. Not even one. I was like, oh my god, and like. I was like, I told him, like, you guys are like fishermen, like, I can't stay around you because they're always catching. So I moved to another spot. And they go crazy too, they don't pay attention. It's, I don't know what it is. It's even sometimes in like on the rocks, like for blues and stuff, same bait, you know, the guy to your left catching them, the guy to your right catching them, and you're like, what's going on? I heard there's like so many different kind of fish before. Like I started fishing there. There's like scarp was there. There was like blackfish was there. But when I got there, they were all gone. They left. But once in a while, I see like a little scarp or flounder. Like there used to be a lot of flounder there, but they're gone too. Yeah, that's what I heard. Salmon. But like, why is that? Why are they leaving? Sometimes I go there in the morning. I just get into it. If there's a school around, I just stay there till like all day, till like 7 at night. The cove probably more like for the little skipjack. But mostly the blues are always on the other side. For bottom fishing, you can't bottom fishing on this side because the water's low, it's all muddy, and there's like a lot of rocks where it's get caught there. But for plugs, stripers hang around inside the cove. Around where the boat area is. When they do come, they just hang around. Sometimes they rush in to feed on the very fish. Ah, I was talking about them, the blues. It's like all over the place. I've like never seen anything. And we look over the guy fishing on the bridge. And it's like all fish like lying on the bridge. They were going through and under the bridge. You know, because like we didn't pay attention here. We didn't think there was anything on the cove. Like we were kind of done, we caught so many fish. So just catching this side, all of a sudden, like a drop, the whole cove was just boiling. It was like firework. We all just kind of stopped fishing and just sat there and watched. It was there like about 4 or 5 hours, just like all day. Yeah, and usually they just come in for a run and then they leave. But that was like a really big school. It was like an amazing. I think that's like, yeah, the DM. See people like had like, some kind of wooden thing they were like carrying on an easy chair and taking them. Yeah. But that was an amazing sight.
And I hate it when the kids go through and rip out those plants. And it was so funny. I was sitting there the other day and there were a bunch of little kids on their bikes. Police officer comes through, she talks with them. They seem to be nice kids and all that stuff. And then she leaves and about 5 minutes later, a different one comes through, just checking on the kids. And then they left. They didn't hassle them, and the little boys were nice. Then they decided to leave, but before they left, for some unknown reason, they went and they just uprooted to, I don't know what kind of plants they are, things with leaves on the top. They just ripped them up and threw them on the picnic table, got on their bikes and left. And I thought, I just watched this. I don't know if they did it in protest to the police. I don't know if they would, with boys, they could just be boys. You know, for no reason at all, let's do this, you know. And I thought, that's so strange. They weren't hassled. They were laughing with the officers. They, you know, but you see all kinds of weird stuff, you know, like that.
No, there's some people always seem to be very nice. They do their own thing. They fish or drinks or whatever. I see now, like, a lot of families just go hang out and fish. Yeah.
Means a lot to me. It's very special. It brings back memories when I was a little girl. So my dad used to bring me over here. And that's why this place is so special to me. And we'd walk out to the rocks, to that big long wall. We'd go fishing. I remember we caught eel out there. We caught a couple of blues.
It's good fishing and picnicking out here. That's what we do.
And another reason it's special also because my first son, he has, he's been gone for 1 year. And his first anniversary, you know, with the memorial after the flowers started dying out, we came here, and me and my husband, we had walk out to the rocks.
Yeah, we throw and, the flowers
out in the ocean. Yeah, so I mean, this place really means a lot. It's very special.
Cat people, they go pretty early too. I met one of the women that bring the cat to food. She said like spend like $80 a week on cat food. Like, and they really look, you know, like a nice cat food. And she go all around and go to the rock looking for them. And they're like, you know, kitty. She named them. She called them. People come out. Cats are beautiful there.
I feel very connected to the place, and I don't know why. There's something about it that touches something deep inside me that's like unnamed. I don't know what it is.
Why I'm connected down here is the safe feelings. No matter when I come down here, I always feel safe. I remember an incident where I was, 11, 12, and we walked from the pool and we walked over the break wall, my girlfriend and I, and we walked that way. And I don't know, we were down. The next thing you know, I was in the water and she thought it was quite funny. But the current was coming, and I'm like, no, I'm really trying to get back. And she's laughing, and I'm laughing, and good thing I was a good swimmer. But, you know, there was the safety net. I got back on to the break wall.
It's fun. It's relaxing. You know, come up with friends. Sometimes just come look to see the sunrise or the sunset. I'll just lay out there in the sun even though there's no fish. Sometimes you get stuck, you know, on the rock. And the high tides come.
I mean, it's stress-free. It's just wonderful. And it's got incredible variety of land and seascape. And I feel very comfortable there.
I just like to walk over and just enjoy the peaceful setting. It's terrific. You know, a place like this is a treasure. So it's just a really beautiful spot. You know, I was just sitting on the same iron bench. And I thought, you know, you sit here and look at all this. You think there's absolutely nothing wrong in the world. You know, and that's why it's a spot like this is special.
Salter Grove. Spring wind bequeaths spring snow, and we are in a quandary of sudden blossom. Winter's testament confounds the fresh young green. The line and granite underfoot cracks in the memory like lost ice. Snow hisses on the dark cove waters, redoubled with swans and seabirds. The hissing, honking, and wing flapping are like respondents at a reading of winter's will. We are the caretakers of that inheritance.
I have very fond memories of Salter Grove.